Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 139, recorded Thursday, March 29th, 2018. This is the podcast giving the voice to the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: brewing the best hotel room coffee and notes on Spain. So coming to you from the Travel Commons studios outside of Chicago, Illinois, just got back Sunday night from 10 days in Spain, about 4 days each in Madrid and San Sebastian, with a couple of days in the Rioja wine region. Trying to say that three times fast. A friend on the East Coast sent me a note while I was in Spain. She said, good week to be out of town. We got whacked with yet another dump of snow. Well, not quite. It's been a cold spring in Europe, and Spain has been no different. Our first weekend in Madrid was in the upper 30s, sort of the low 40s, with just an ugly mix of rain and wet snow. Carrying around an umbrella, not quite sure what to do. Which, you know, then just turned into just snow as we drove up to Rioja. I'll tell you, some of that drive reminded me of driving through I-70 in the Colorado Rockies in winter. You know, you go in a tunnel, it's fine weather, the sun's shining, you come out the other side of that tunnel, and it's just all blowing snow. Now, having said that, it was nothing like the sort of 7 or 9 or 14 inches that winter storm, what are they calling this one, Toby, dropped on the East Coast last week. And I got to tell you, even with lousy weather, the food and the wine in Spain makes it tough to sustain any sort of cranky attitude, even though it did shorten up our Pintos crawl through Logroño. We flew Iberia Airlines to Madrid because, A, they have a nonstop flight from Chicago, and B, as I mentioned a few episodes ago, I was finally able to burn off some of those Avios points that had been sort of collecting cobwebs in my British Airways account. So given that we had a slug of points, I decided to try Iberia's premium economy service on the flight over, that overnight flight. Now, you know, sort of most airlines are actually trying this out, both American and European airlines. It's kind of a tweener service, trying to capture revenue from people willing to pay a bit more for some comfort, but, you know, just aren't willing to, you know, go for the 200% to 300% business class uplift, you know, at least when it's coming out of their own pocket. And it was truly a tweener service, about five rows kind of wedged between the business and regular coach cabins. And, you know, and these coach seats, so they were like regular coach seats, but they had kind of the spacing and increased recline that was kind of somewhere between what we'd see in, let's say, a domestic first class and, say, you know, like United's Economy Plus. The meal service was the same as economy, but they served us first, and they gave us, you know, kind of a little amenities kit with really was just the essentials: earplugs, an eye mask, socks, toothbrush, toothpaste. So it was kind of as advertised, coach with a bit more space, which made for better napping on that 8-hour flight over. I've talked in past episodes that I really question anymore the value for money trade-off for business class on transatlantic flights on sort of a 5, 6, 7, 8 hour flight. But I have to tell you that, you know, these tweener, at least on Iberia, this tweener class seemed to be kind of a reasonable deal. I will say that the deeper recline of the premium economy seat also makes it easier for you to stay in your space, kind of, you know, between, in the silo that is your space that you've paid for. Makes it easier to stay in that space when you sleep. On the way back, I was in regular coach because, well, I'm cheap and I didn't need to sleep. But the guy next to me did. He nodded off as soon as we left the ground, which meant he didn't recline his seat, which meant that he started to sort of list over to port toward my shoulder. Now, this guy, it was kind of interesting. He kind of looked like he was the younger brother of Dos Equis, the most interesting man. But I'll tell you what, there was no amount of interesting that was going to have him sleeping on my shoulder. So just as he was about ready to touch down on my shoulder, I gave our seat row a little bit of a shake. Some, I don't know, call it single row turbulence. He startled awake, realized what he was doing, and immediately sat straight up. I thought to myself, hey, stay upright, my friend. Hey, so following up, just a quick addendum to the luggage thread we've been running over the past couple of episodes. In the last episode, Jerry Sarfati talked about downsizing from a 22-inch to a 20-inch carry-on bag because of the hassles he'd gotten from American Airlines gate agents. I mentioned that I hadn't had any problems from American, and I didn't get pulled over again, you know, on this last trip. Iberia, on my Chicago to Madrid flight, I didn't have a problem, which just goes to show you, you know, prove the point on how much discretion gate agents really have. They can be really nice or they can be really cranky. I did not get a chance to test this theory on the way back home on the Madrid to Chicago flight. Two bottles bought in Rioja tasting rooms and a tin of olive oil definitely tipped me over the carry-on liquid limit. The EU's no mobile roaming rules also let me skip what had become, and I've talked about on past episodes, our ritual on our first day of European vacation, burning a couple of hours in a phone store buying local SIM cards for our mobile phones. So with the new regulations, instead of having to, you know, kind of track down the Orange store, instead, the week before that we left, so still in Chicago, I fired up EE's iPhone app and topped up our UK SIMs. And then somewhere, I don't know, sort of over the Bay of Biscay, after my breakfast tray was cleared, I pulled out the little SIM popping out tool and swapped out my AT&T SIM for the UK, this EE UK SIM. Once on the ground, I turned on the phone and, hey, I was just good to go. And because we got the whole family on EE, and so everybody's got those SIMs, it was, you know, easier to call each other when we got separated on our Pinchos crawls. I know that everybody just messages nowadays, but I'm still one of those knuckle draggers who occasionally finds talking quicker than texting. While in Madrid, I also had the chance to add to my Subway tap-and-go collection for about €2.50, or about $3 in current exchange rates. The interesting twist on the Madrid system is that you can tap up to 4 people through the turnstile with a single card on a single trip. So actually, I only had to buy 1 tap card for the whole family. I'd load it up with 10 rides, which seemed to be the only option, and then we'd line up behind one turnstile and then tap through and pass the card back. Yeah, and then getting out, we just walk through the turnstile, since Madrid Metro fare system seems to be based on zones rather than kind of the starting and the ending station. So you didn't have to tap out, you just walk through. And so now I just add that card to my growing stack of tap and go cards. Also, in past episodes, we've talked about how I've really come to like and value the service I get from Hertz with their President's Club status. And so I rented a car from Hertz in Madrid for our drive up to Rioja for wine tasting and then over to San Sebastian and back. On Tuesday morning, we headed over to Madrid's Atocha train station, found the Hertz counter, and then I sent my family to go get breakfast because I knew from past experience renting cars in Spain that I was probably in for a solid 30 minutes of hard upselling. And it didn't disappoint me. It didn't matter that I already booked online at Hertz.com and selected the options that I wanted. I just I was going to get sold. Mel, the Hertz agent, spoke excellent American English, all the right terms, the right slang, the right colloquialisms, telling me that the rate I booked online was crazy low because I'd used our corporate rate, plus I'd cashed in some Hertz points. But he's telling me I'm crazy low because I don't have any insurance. And then I knew it was coming. Then comes the big push, writing down, oh, well, here's the big liability numbers, the huge damage possibilities. Even though a lot of this was already covered by our corporate rate and the various credit cards that I was booking this on. And then after the insurance, then came the push to upsell for the, upsell the car. You know, did you know you booked a manual? Can you drive a manual? Because, well, of course, no Americans actually know how to work a clutch. I just smiled and nodded and let Mel work through the spiel because, I don't know. I'd kind of hoped that my status would save me from this, but nope, there was no short-circuiting this. Mel was going to go all the way through. And after he was done, I just said no to everything. And then there's some up and back that you still got to grind through. You really sure? Finally got the keys just as my family finished breakfast, and then off we went. You know, I would have been a lot more frustrated if I hadn't expected it and hadn't budgeted time for it. Instead, I was just slightly weary and glad that my wife had got me a coffee to go. And in, I don't know, what's become kind of the obligatory craft beer segment of Travel Commons, having the rental car let me hit the Basque Brewing Project tap room that was just outside of San Sebastian. It was, I don't know, it had a very American feel to it, winding through a light industrial area, finding the place by spotting picnic tables in front of the open loading door, walking past the foosball table and the kind of the shelves holding 20 kilo sacks of malt, then the kind of pink fluorescent cord blocking access to the brewing area, all very typical to what you would see here in the U.S., and probably for a good reason, because the place is owned by three Americans. One of them was working the taps when we arrived. He quickly flipped from Spanish to English when he heard our accents when we ordered. Originally from Baltimore, he said he came over, it's about 6 years ago, when his wife wanted to move back home. And nice guy, and it was good beer. Wouldn't have gotten it if we hadn't rented the car and dealt with Mel's spiel. Rob Cheshire, a Travel Commons listener and Untapped friend for me, hit the comment section on the last episode first to egg me on about my comment in the last episode about doing a one city, five tap rooms layover video, and then asking about tap rooms near Wrigley Field when he comes in to see the Reds play the Cubs. I managed to string together a six tap room crawl for him. He may need to break that up into a couple of rounds. And to Rob's first question, I've decided I will do a tap room layover video, but instead of basing it out of O'Hare, like my last layover video, I'm going to do this one from Midway. Give the Southwest Flyers some love, and also it'll let me hit four tap rooms that have been opened in the past couple of years in what can only truly be described as the post-industrial landscape of Chicago's near South Side. So of the Bridgeport and Pilsen neighborhoods, if you're familiar with Chicago. It should be fun. I'm kind of working on scheduling everything now. Probably will shoot it in April, maybe toward the end of April. And then with the additional production time that video requires, it might not get up until May, but I'll keep everybody posted. And then one last thing. Last week, I tweeted out a link to, I thought it was a pretty good, pretty rigorous study from the Fly Healthy research team out of Emory University in Atlanta. Guess they're probably getting a little Delta funding there. but the paper was about passenger movements on transcontinental flights in the U.S. and what it means for the spread of respiratory diseases. It was really a good paper. The team took 10 flights, logged passenger movements, took air samples, and then swabs of hard surfaces, and then cultured those. I'm not going to take you through the entire study. I'll put a link in the show notes for those who want to read it, or you can check the my Twitter feed, which I encourage you to do. It's actually very readable as scientific papers go. But just to summarize, the main takeaways for me were: A, you really only have to be concerned about the people immediately in front, behind, and next to you, sort of a one row radius. So if you hear somebody coughing five rows back, don't sweat it. B, the people wiping down their trays, armrests, seat buckles with Purell wipes are wasting their time. And then C, if you're really worried, if you're still really worried, get a window seat in the front part of the plane and don't leave it for the entire flight, which, you know, kind of as a side benefit, will also endear you to your roommates. I tell you, as in the past, I've called planes flying petri dishes, so I was actually pleasantly surprised by the Emory team's findings. And hey, if you have any travel questions, a story, comment, travel tip, the voice of the traveler, send it along to email address comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com. You can always use your smartphone to record and send an audio comment, send a Twitter message to M. Peacock, or you can post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page, or go old school like Rob Cheshire and post them on the website at travelcommons.com. So the first topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is perfect coffee on the road. I have invited onto the Travel Commons podcast Coleman Collins, who writes the Road Warrior blog, roadwarrior.blog. You got to love that URL. I am so jealous, Coleman, of that URL.
I was honestly floored that I could get it when I did.
What really caught my eye was a post that you had at the beginning of February, just entitled High Quality Coffee in a Hotel Room. I've been known to absolutely geek out on coffee. I mean, I've got the obligatory Chemex and the Bonavita sort of gooseneck kettle for the controlled pour over. And I can go down that rabbit hole with the best of them. But Coleman, I think your article, you went way deeper in that sort of OCD way that we just sort of love at Travel Commons. So I guess the first question really is kind of, well, what took you down that rabbit hole in the first place?
Oh, good Lord. My first job ever was as a barista. It's been in the veins for a long time. I think I was 16 when I had that job. Coffee is something that it's a small comfort to me. And it's funny, right? Because I'm actually not much of a gear guy for the rest of my packing or travel stuff, like at all. Like I have a sort of a normal, boring, whatever Wirecutter thinks is the best suitcase. And I don't do space cubes and I don't do any of that stuff. My toiletry bag is too big. But coffee was like the one that I decided I wanted to get right, because I was just done with like the little tiny acrid tasting hotel room coffee. There's something about like at 6 a.m. when I get up to actually be able to make that coffee in the hotel room and like have it be the first thing that I do every day. It's sort of a centering morning ritual. So it was worth optimizing.
Well, there you go. So it's a great article both about coffee and gear. And we all love gear. So when you were kind of selecting that gear, I mean, what was your criteria? What was that evaluation criteria? What was the checklist and how did you make those choices?
Well, it's been a sort of a random walk, actually. A lot of the gear testing was honestly an excuse to buy new things, which I'm sure you've experienced. The only thing I don't do is bring a kettle at this point. I actually do now bring a scale with me. It's an AWS 600. It can only do up 600 grams, but it's wonderful for what it does. But the initial thing was actually a conversation with a friend of mine, Pete Hodgson, who also has a travel coffee post that you can read. And I linked to it on my blog post. And my initial setup was exactly his, because I was complaining to him about this one day. I was like, I can't find good coffee. I think we were in Cincinnati. I can't find good coffee in Cincinnati. It just, there actually is one place, but it wasn't near the office that we were working in. And he's like, well, this is what I do. I have an AeroPress and I have this thing and I have that thing. I was like, great, I'm going to try it. Next week, I brought it. It worked pretty well, but it didn't work exactly how I wanted it to. And that kicked off like the 4-year quest to eventually replace almost everything in that kit, because now I use a collapsible dripper. I have a scale. I traveled with a thermometer for a while to get water temperature correct. But I stopped doing that because you can actually estimate the water temperature pretty accurately if you know the vessel you're using. It's just been an obsession.
So you started to go down that path. What is in your kit? What have you what have you sort of settled on now?
So, the other big criterion that I forgot to mention is it all has to fit in the Klein Tools bag. Klein Tools is a Midwestern company that makes these canvas carry-all bags that they're like my packing system for everything. That's what my pens go into. It's what my passport goes into. It's what I have several different ones for different things. So it's got to fit in one of those because that's just how I organize my suitcase and my travel bag. So in that Klein Tools bag, which is step one of the process, I have a Snowpeak foldable dripper, which is made of stainless steel. So I've tried a few different collapsible dripper styles, and that one works the best for me because it's a little heavier, it's a little larger, but it's sturdy. Everything else that I've ever used, it like wiggles on the cup, which if you're dealing with near boiling water and a lot of coffee grounds, not great.
At 6 o'clock in the morning, that's not a great way to start a day.
Exactly. I have some apologies to make to the Westin in Wilmington, Delaware for learning that fact the hard way. And so that's my dripper right now. And it's nice because it can take V60 filters or like standard Melita filters, like the flat bottom ones, which means that if I forget to bring some, I can actually go to a CVS and buy them, which is nice. I have an AWS 600, which I mentioned already, which is a scale that you can just buy on Amazon. It's like $7. It's very cheap. And if you buy it, you will get advertisements for marijuana related products because apparently it's a big scale in the drug community, which I did not know when I bought it.
I saw these
things on Amazon after. I was like, I don't want rolling papers.
These are fun facts to know and tell, right?
Yeah. And then I have a Porlex, a full size Porlex. So a lot of people recommend the travel size Porlex. Porlex is a stainless steel hand grinder. It's a ceramic burr and stainless steel body. It's a great little grinder. It's the most expensive part of the kit by far. You're still looking at under $100 for all of these things, but that is the majority of that price. It's about $60. But it is so much better than the Hario Mini Mill hand grinder, which is about half the price and also about a quarter of the quality, I've found, both in grind consistency and also just durability. Because like I'm throwing this in a bag every week, and that stainless steel body really does help.
I will link to your blog post in the show notes because you've got the whole kit with links out to Amazon to make it easy. So the final question is any new stuff that you're looking at?
I actually just bought something new for the kit a week ago. I actually mentioned at the bottom of the article as the next thing I'm probably going to try. I did, in fact, do it. It's a camp mug made by a camping company called Mir, M-I-I-R, and it's an insulated camp mug. So my problem is I love and travel with my Zoji Rushi travel mug, but it's not a shape that you can put a dripper on top of, which means I would need to use a second vessel, like a paper cup or something, and then or a camp mug, an older camp mug that I used a lot, and then pour it into the Zoji Rushi. This is an insulated camp mug, so it's a double wall stainless steel camp mug, and it's really great. It works super well. They actually do make titanium versions of this. Mir doesn't, but other companies do. I didn't need the titanium. I didn't need that weight savings because it's going in a suitcase or a backpack, not a backpacking bag.
But you were tempted. You were tempted to get the
titanium. Of course I was.
I mean, who's not titanium, right?
I justified it to myself because the Mir mug has a handle and I like having a handle.
There you go. I can see that. Well, Coleman, thank you very much. I appreciate you coming out of the podcast and kind of spinning the coffee propeller a little bit.
Absolutely.
You did mention at the top, you talked about a book that you're writing. Do you want to give us a quick overview of that?
Sure, I'd love to. So the book is also called The Road Warrior. You can find it at theroadwarriorbook.com. And it's a much larger contemplation on kind of half a decade of travel and how to stay, I think the tagline is healthy, sane, and productive on the road. And so that's kind of the big things are like eating well, how to make an exercise program that isn't horrible, that can be done in a hotel gym. And when I say isn't horrible, I mean doesn't feel like a chore. And then some contemplations on productivity on the road, on building and maintaining habits, on a few other things like that. It's shaping up to come out this spring or summer. It's a little tough right now because this is actually not my full-time job. This is my side project. So this spring or summer, though, we're working through the second draft right now.
Super. Well, we'll check it out when it comes out. So anyhow, thanks very much for taking the time, Coleman, out of what I can imagine is a busy schedule.
There is a lot to do. Thanks for having me.
Take care. So the second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is notes from Spain. This was our fourth spring trip to Spain. Our first trip, we hit Madrid and Barcelona, the usual suspects. The next trip, we headed south to Andalusia, Cordoba, Granada, Ronda, Seville during Semana Santa, Holy Week, and saw the penitential processions every day in every town, big, small, and the cities, ending up in the huge Holy Thursday night into Good Friday morning procession, set of processions, kind of nonstop processions outside of the Seville Cathedral. And then the next trip in 2016, we actually headed back down south, but even went further, taking a boat across the Straits of Gibraltar from Tarifa, Spain, to Tangier, Morocco. Now, for this trip, we sort of gave up the warm weather of the south for some new territory, Rioja and the Basque Country. Now, as I said at the top of the show, for me, Spain is all about food and wine. Now, there's certainly cultural stuff. Like I said before, the Semana Santa processions are just phenomenal cultural events. Standing in front of the huge canvas that is Picasso's Guernica in the Reina Sofia Museum in Madrid, phenomenal. The Mezquita, what was a church and then a mosque and then a church again in Cordoba, great stuff. But it's really sort of the food and the wine that keep bringing us back. On our first trip to Granada a few years back, we were staying in a Marriott, and it might have been, I don't know, might have been one of their AC properties, but it was in the middle of Granada. It was just a great building. It's a beautiful building. It had been a convent, I think, at one time, and there was an interior courtyard. And so one night we ended up having a nightcap there, four of us, after dinner. Four glasses of wine at a hotel bar. I'm kind of doing the math in my head. I'm figuring, you know, sort of 12 to 15 bucks a glass. So I'm waiting for sort of the 40 euro tab. It ends up being 12 euros. And that's when I decide I love this country. The Pinchos Kral was the food center kind of for this trip north, first in Logroño in Rioja, and then in San Sebastian, right on the Bay of Biscay in Basque Country. Sort of walking from bar to bar, a glass of wine and a bite at each. It was a good mix of food. In Logroño, we started at a couple of, I'd call them sort of divier, more local places that focused just on sort of one bite, sautéed mushrooms at one place, a sort of a ground lamb kind of kebabish sandwich at the next. The meat was seared on a flat grill behind the bar and then served on a bun with this, I don't know, this great green sauce. And then they were all serving, you know, some of the local wine, the local Rioja wine. Logroño is the capital of the Rioja region, kind of pulling the bottles from a bucket at the end of the bar. It was great, just kind of hanging out. And then we sort of swung around the corner into what was a distinctly higher-end place, kind of complete with a Michelin sticker on the front door, more variety of food, kind of seared red tuna, pickled white anchovies, grilled octopus, and kind of the next level up of Rioja wines. And great, you know, just great place, different from the dive places. And that actually, that variety is what you kind of love about those food crawls. Later in the week in San Sebastian, when the weather turned a bit better, we could see the crawl pick up volume in the pedestrian streets of the old town there in San Sebastian near the ocean. People still bundle up a bit, but taking their wine outside and, you know, kind of standing at some of the stand-up tables, kind of and willing to walk to the next place rather than sort of hunkering down for a couple of courses in a single restaurant, you know, kind of cuddling for warmth. Cider is also big in the Basque Country and actually across the north coast of Spain. So not only the Basque Country, but then over into Asturias. It's drier, not as sweet as what you get in the U.S. and the U.K. You could almost think of it almost like an apple wine, but it's also lower in alcohol, more like sort of 4 or 5%. So I really like it. And during the cider season, which is sort of now, January through April, the ciderias, the cider houses that are in the hills outside of San Sebastian open up to serve cider streamed directly from the taps of these kind of huge chestnut wood barrels that that they're aging the cider in, or at least letting it ferment in. But they open up taps in these barrels, and these barrels are taller than I am, and it just sort of that you stream the cider straight from the tap into your glass, and then sort of the glass behind you, and the guys, and it ends up being a big, almost like conga line. And then they serve a traditional menu of, and typically what we would see is kind of salt cod omelet, and then fresh cod fried with peppers and onions, and then some big whacking grilled T-bone steak served. And this whole thing is either served standing up at stand-up tables or at sit-down on communal tables. We ended up sharing kind of the hall or the cideria with a busload. It had to be actually maybe a couple of busloads of folks that had just come. They come over the border from France. A couple dozen of us lined up as a worker manned the tap in one of these big cider barrels. Opened the tap up. He's, you know, this thin stream of cider comes out. And so we've lined up our wide mouth plastic tumblers about 3 feet away out and down and, you know, following the arc of the cider stream. And you kind of catch it that far away because it imparts a bit of a fizz to kind of the three fingers of cider that you catch in that glass before moving out of the stream to let it hit the tumbler of the guy who's holding his glass right below yours. It was a great time and just a lot of fun. It's something you're not going to see over in the U.S. I have to say, though, for a great food country, the food at Madrid Airport is, I can only say it's a bit pedestrian. So to extend our food extravaganza for sort of one more meal, we skip the, for lack of a better term, the meh restaurants in the airport and instead buy a package of really top-end Iberian ham, the bellota, from the free-range Iberian pigs that are fattening up on acorns. Now, you can't bring it into the U.S., but you know what? It's an 8-hour flight from Madrid to Chicago, and I've never had that package make it all the way to the U.S. landfall. Okay, that's it. That is the end of Travel Commons podcast number 139. I hope you all enjoyed the show. I hope you decide to stay subscribed. Better yet, I hope you tell some of your friends, loved ones, colleagues, people you run into on the street, tell them to subscribe too. You can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes. Actually, I got a note from somebody who pointed out that at the end of February, Travel Commons was one of the top movers, was on the number 29 on the top mover chart on Stitcher. So had moved up, I don't know how many places in their chart, but for everybody who's listening on Stitcher, hi. And thanks for listening. But again, you can find us on Stitcher, on SoundCloud, and on iTunes. Also, check out the show notes for music links. And hey, if you've got a travel story, a thought, a comment, gripe, moans, groans, cries of anguish, the voice of the traveler, send them along, text or audio file to comments, COMMENTS, at travelcommons.com or to mpeacock on Twitter. Write them on the Travel Commons Facebook page or post them on our website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who has taken the time to send in emails, tweets, post comments on the website. And until we talk again, till we talk in April, travel safe. Thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Take care. Bye now.